This episode is presented by Henry's Wine and Spirit.
Now streaming from HRN, this is The Feed Feed. I'm Jay Cohen, editorial director of The Feed Feed, the world's largest crowdsourced food publication and social media community, serving as your daily source of what to cook, bake, and drink. Occasionally joined by our co-founders, Julie and Dan Resnick, we sit down with leaders and upstarts of the food media realm.
So we often say that we're, as Feed Feed, answering this sort of age-old question, which is, what do we eat for fill-in-the-blank, breakfast, lunch, dinner?
Our approach to doing so involves lifting up voices from culinary content creators all over the world, no matter how big or small their following is. This podcast takes the democratization of food media one step further by giving a behind-the-scenes look of the Epicurean magazines, websites, videos, and accounts you digest every day. We'll discuss everything from breaking into the industry, navigating social media.
That's been my bigger social media thing is like, I think like I just get bored very quickly. And even when things are working really well, I'm like, everyone's doing this. I don't want to do this anymore.
Building and growing a community.
People are like, why is it five E's? And I'm like, I don't know. When you say eats, how many E's does that feel like it sounds like? And that's why. No real good rhyme or reason to any of it, but that's also kind of been our style this whole time.
And producing content that resonates with young and old.
You know, if someone doesn't like my writing or the photographs of my book or the design, that's subjective. But if I see that a recipe didn't work, that I really failed someone.
So whether you want to know what goes into food styling a magazine cover, the process of getting a cookbook deal, understanding what the hell TikTok is, or grasping how a recipe can go viral.
I mean, I guess the thing about going viral, too, is that then it's out there. And people start claiming it as their own. And that's happened a few times recently with that tart, which is sort of depressing.
But... drag them. Name names.
I'm not naming any names, but you know who you are.
We'll be covering it all. This is the Feed Feed Podcast. Subscribe to the Feed Feed wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Natalie Johnson. We'll talk to Natalie about wine, opening a restaurant, Anton's, and more. We'll taste a red wine from Sicily for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben-Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. All right, Natalie Johnson grew up around food and drink with her family. Her dad further exposed her with a trip to Italy when she was 15. Natalie moved to New York City in 2010 and cut her teeth on some downtown restaurants, cementing her love for wine. She has worked with Jack Mason at Marta, Bobby Stuckey at Frasca, and Dan Kluger at Loring Place. Natalie recently left Loring Place to become GM and beverage manager for Antoine's in New York City with star chef Nick Anderer and looming in the background, the Franks. Welcome to the Grape Nation.
Thank you,
Natalie.
So excited to be here.
As the intro implied, you've been around and you ain't old, so there's a lot going on. Not in a short period of time, but through the year. So I want everyone to sort of get a context of your journey in life and wine. When did the wine thing start as far as career?
The wine thing for me started a little bit later than I feel a lot of young sommeliers today got the bug very early. You know, kind of in college or high school even. Sometimes you hear these stories like Jack Mason. But for me, I've worked in restaurants since I was 16 in high school. I always had to have a job during, you know, school breaks. and I got the restaurant bug is what really bit me. So in college, I decided I wanted to be a chef and started cooking in restaurants in Boulder, in Denver, and then moved to New York to cook.
Did you ever do cooking schools or anything, or
no,
just learn in the kitchen?
I just learned, yeah, learned on the job. I did visit Hyde Park one Thanksgiving before I was before I graduated from university, just to see if that would be the next step for me. But I didn't feel it was the right move. I just wanted to continue.
Why? Too intense, or?
No, I had already been working in restaurants, cooking, hosting, back waiting. You know, I'd already been doing all the things, and so I just wanted to continue working.
Okay, yeah. So keep me going.
So moved to New York in 2010, like you said. Found a job as a pizza cook at Coe Company. Jim Leahy's, you know, it
who
was
a legendary
really, yeah.
baking guy.
Yeah. And I actually wound up there because I was talking to a chef. Someone in Denver connected me with Doug Saltis, actually. Chef.
Who's that?
He was a chef. He lives, he's now based in Chicago and D.C. And he had, you know, I think he had quite a great career in New York, which he was kind of wrapping up his time in New York when I was just getting here. But someone connected me with him. He was the chef at a small restaurant down where the Mermaid Inn is now on McDougal. It's called Smith's. And he sat me down. He didn't have any room for me in his kitchen. So he sat me down and he said, I want you to think about restaurants and food in a different way. You know, you don't have to, if you want to be in this business, you don't have to just be a line cook or just, you know, be on that path to be a chef. There are so many ways you can engage with food. You can, you know, go apprentice with a butcher. You can learn about cheese. You can learn everything there is to know about bread. So that kind of opened up my mind, and I started reading about Jim Leahy. And
is that the first guy that sort of enlightened you about the industry, like took a little time to?
There were a few very distinct, poignant conversations that I had with a few different people, and that was one of them. Another one was this guy, Julian, who I had a phone call with. Again, someone knew I was moving to New York. I was just a young pup. And they connected me with him, and he was like, okay, you have to know a few things. You need to read the New York Times Review every Wednesday. You need to pick up a New York magazine and, you know, read that food section. You need to, you know, what, I don't know. I don't.
Right. Just all the relevant high-profile stuff.
Yeah. Like, you're not in Boulder. You're not in Denver anymore.
Right. Good advice.
Yeah. So.
All right. So you're at Co. making pizza?
Making pizza.
Then what happens?
Then I realize I want to get into the front of the house, be more guest-facing, and just learn a bit more about the business. So I started...
Why? I mean, why didn't you... Why wasn't it clear? Did you need to do everything to realize what you thought you'd like?
Yeah, I mean, for me, my love is restaurants. So I've just always had this curiosity about the business, and you know, the energy of restaurants is what compels me and motivates me. And so, yeah, I had spent about a year and a half ish in the kitchen at Co, and I was just ready to learn more about and meet more people in you
but
know,
but
in
you
New York.
Realize then front of the house, not back, or yeah. At least move and try it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I mean, I love, you know, I love the kitchen. I love food. That's kind of, I have a fascination with the palate. So it, you know, it begins and ends there for me. But I wanted, yeah, I don't know what was really in that moment making me want to move to the front. But
do you move? You move and move to the front where?
I worked at this small restaurant on Allen Street, which closed maybe 6 years ago. Yeah, it was called Sorella. It was opened by two young women, and their focus was on the food and wine of Piedmont in northwestern Italy.
Take it.
And it was, you know, it was kind of cool and cutting edge for the time, I think. You know, it was just Allen Street. There was nothing down there at that time. Now, you know, you have the Lower East Side with, you know, you have Contra and Wild Air and all these cool, funky restaurants that are so important and relevant, but these two young women were doing a really cool thing down there at the time. And so I was happy to be there. I started as a back waiter and then became a server and eventually was helping, you know, manage here and there. It was such a tiny restaurant that I just had some administrative duties.
How long were you there?
Off and on a couple of years.
All right. Then obviously it's time to get out of a place like that. Where do you go?
So then I went to Oto, because that was really, I think my curiosity for wine really started to grow there.
At Sorella or at Oto?
At Sorella.
Okay.
So I was like,
okay. So that's the point where wine became more of a higher topic to you?
Yeah. And I was, you know, I was serving and I was talking to people about food, and I always kind of had an easy time talking about food because I've done it my whole life. My, you know, it's a thing.
Passion.
It's a topic of conversation all the time. And wine, I wasn't able to, you know, I wasn't able to talk with an informed perspective. So I was like, okay, I want to learn about wine. And I, actually one of the former, I think she was a former wine director here of Roberta's.
Amanda?
Krista Voisin.
Uh-huh.
She and I had worked together briefly at Sorella, and then she took the wine director position at Oto. And so she knew I was curious about wine and invited me over there for a trail. And that was my first wine job.
What kind
wild.
Of food is was Oto or is Oto?
It's pizza.
Pizza?
My life is, yeah.
The pizza guy.
Yeah.
All right, so you do that for how long?
I was there for a year as well.
Did they have some small curated wines? I mean, your exposure to some newer things were happening there?
I mean, they had a great cellar. You know, as part of the Batali Bastianich group, they had a lot of buying power. And so there was a lot of old Barolo, Barbaresco, a lot of old Tuscan.
See, it
wine.
Just hit me that it's Otto, not Oto. You called it. I know exactly what Otto is.
Yeah.
I thought Oto was like Japanese.
I mean,
it was a beautiful location,
and
they were wine-centric, and it was pizza and all the other stuff. I get it now.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's like a real place.
Yeah.
So does she shepherd you through some of the wine? I mean, you get some good knowledge dropped on you from her?
Definitely. From her and also the team of sommeliers that was there at the time. You know, it was kind of a cool restaurant because it was so casual. And it was a restaurant, it opened, I think, within a few years of Babbo. And it was the place that really allowed so many people access to what Batali and Bastianich were doing at the time. And, you know, they were getting so much.
A great neighborhood.
Yeah. But it was a wild place. I mean, we used to do 700, 1,000 covers on a Friday night.
It's
it was
popular.
Just an absolute machine. So it was a great place. So we had somms on the floor, and I was definitely the greenest when I joined. I did not know much about wine. But I just kind of, so I just pushed and really studied, and, the somm team that was there at the time was so awesome. So I learned a lot from them. We studied a lot, yeah.
Why do you leave there?
I was in a study group.
Wine study group?
Wine study group, yeah, studying for, you know, the intro. I think I was just doing my intro and then my certified through the court at that time. And I was in a study group that met every Sunday at Gramercy Tavern. We met in the back room before Gramercy Tavern opened, and we had someone who was mentoring our group, and he knew that Marta was opening, and so he suggested maybe I look into that as a next move.
So you take the job of Marta?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say I take it. Jack and I laughed because he was like, oh, I didn't know about you. But he ended up offering me the position, and then we got along very well and are great friends today. But he was...
What year are we talking?
That was 2014.
Okay,
yeah.
So you're 4 years in the city now. You're at Marta. You're with Union Square.
Yeah.
Hospitality. So now, not that anyone previous to that wasn't real, but now you're with a real wine guy, right?
Yeah.
Now, before we talk about that, are you studying for certification?
I had already passed certified. So while I was at Oto, I was... Again, you know, because I wanted to know what I was talking about.
Right.
It was a great place to to have, you know, a first somm job because it's casual, it's pizza, you know. You know, they had a serious list, serious wine, but I was able to kind of work with a lot of those wines, and I always had support on the floor, so if there was something I didn't know, I could, you know, call one of the other somms over. And then, but yeah, I was kind of aggressively studying at that time, and then past certified before.
Does that list open up more to anything you did? Like, we know Jack loves champagne, which is unusual for Italian and pizza and other places. Did you start getting exposed?
Yeah, just, I mean, exposed to all of the, it's all Italian, so everything was new. Everything was new there. So I distinctly remember opening some of these bottles for the first time, and some of these wines and producers are still some of my favorites. So,
Kidding.
Yeah.
All right, so you stay at Marta with Jack for how long?
I was there for a year. I absolutely loved my experience there. I loved working for Union Square Hospitality Group at that time. It was just a really exciting opening. I was so proud, you know, to be a part of it, and there was so much great energy, and I loved Nick's food. And
so we mentioned Nick is the chef at Anton's.
Yes.
To tie it, you go back with Nick to Marta around 2014.
Yeah.
And he's there the whole tenure that you're there, too,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he was the, you know, founding chef partner of that restaurant. So it was just so great to be a part of that. And I left after a year and moved to Colorado. My life brought me to Colorado.
That's a bold move. You're from Colorado, the Denver Boulder area. You went to, you're a Buff. Don't get into it, but you had to go back for a reason, whether it was family or related.
Family, yeah.
Okay. So you go back to Boulder.
Yeah.
But something good happens, right?
Yeah. I mean, the best, you know, I got to work for one of the best, most important, you know, restaurateurs in our country, I think.
For sure. Not just Colorado.
Yeah.
And that is?
And that's Bobby Stuckey.
Who is still at Frasca.
Frasca. And now his, you know, he's growing a little empire.
Empire. Tavernetta.
Yeah,
and Tavernetta. The pizza place.
Yep. Sunday Vinyl, a new wine.
Right. Just recently opened.
Wine bar.
So you go, just tell me how that comes about. You had to go back, so you sought it out, or?
Yeah, I connected with Bobby, and I kind of knew Bobby just from, you know, the industry and from growing up in the area and staying connected. He, you know, I would serve him at various restaurants that I worked at in New York, and he was always so lovely and would, you know, acknowledge me, and we'd just, you know, chat a bit. And so when I was headed back to Colorado, I connected with him and said, you know, I would love to trail and would love the opportunity to work with you. And so
did it happen right away?
Yeah, it happened
when
right away.
When you got there, you got right in there?
Yes, but everyone starts as a polisher at Frasca. So
no exception for you?
No.
Even with a few years, more than a few years in New York?
No, which I think it was very challenging, but, you know, I respect...
What, polishing glasses?
Yeah, just, you know, you know, mentally, you know, you have to have some endurance and... And it was just generally a challenging time for me in my life, and so it was a hard transition to make, you know, because I had opened this restaurant in New York that I was so excited about. And
how quickly do things move there?
Not quickly, because
I mean, you're polishing glasses for weeks and months.
Months.
Oh, Jesus.
Months.
Sucks.
It's Altos. Okay. It's Alto glassware. And then you move from polisher to food runner, and then food runner to back server, and then eventually to front server, and then eventually, I mean, he has MS, Master Sommelier candidates on his team, who are back servers, you know, because, I mean, I think he's expanded now, so he has more places to put people, but at that time... It was just Frasca a couple of years ago. Yeah. It was still just Frasca and, of course, the pizzeria.
So how long are you there, and what do you leave as?
I left as a back server, front server, and I did a couple of cool... he created a couple of cool moments for me to help with wine, like special wine dinners. I did a dinner with one of their chefs that featured the food of Alto Adige, food and wine of Alto Adige. So we did, we had a fun, you know, fun evening there in the private room. But yeah, I was doing mostly back server.
But even though you're doing all that, do you are, what am I trying to say? Do they let those guys access tastings and they take time for education?
Yes.
And when they do pre-week or pre-night prep, you're part of that. And
yeah, it's really like you can take it as far as you want to take it. And they give everyone that freedom, and you know, they empower people to learn there. That's, you know, that's what they do best, I think, and that's what's created such a strong community and strong network for them. So
it seems like for some reason you have to go to Boulder, and for another reason it could be time to leave, because it wouldn't be the worst thing to maybe become a sommelier at Frasca, but it sounds like, you know, maybe there was an opportunity for different reasons to get out. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, for me, my heart was broken for New York, and I, you know, this is a place that just makes me feel so right and so happy.
So what happens? You leave Frasca to come to New York?
Yeah.
To where?
To Loring Place. So okay. To open Loring Place. So that was another, you know.
So you were there at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
When Dan left ABC and he got the spot on 8th Street and all that.
Yeah. Yeah, so I, you know, most of his opening management team was ABC alum.
He brought over?
Yeah.
What was your connection? That you
Zero.
Know, that's a good gig. So how do you wind up as the opening
aggressive.
Crew? So it was on you.
I was very aggressive.
You must have been convincing.
Yeah.
Because you're no slouch. Dan's no slouch. His project was, you know, well documented and heralded.
Yeah.
I guess you won him over.
Yeah, I worked hard just to, you know, communicate that I was the person for this. I mean, I was so nervous. I had never written the list. I had never been a buyer or an assistant buyer or anything. But I just knew I wanted it so badly that I knew I was the one just because
of
that.
That's so. Like the greatest thing. Now, a lot of people say, you know, I'll get in there and I'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Most people figure it out. Some don't. I mean, I'm sure it was challenging, but were you able to, you know, set it up the way you wanted, he wanted, compatible with the vision?
Yeah, I really was. And he really kind of gave me free rein. I mean, it was ideal, you know, because he trusted me. And
is Dan a good guy?
Good guy. Very
Seems
good
like
guy.
A good guy.
I got a message from him today, actually.
We'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
So you recently left Loring. How long were you there?
I was there for about 2.5 years.
Wow, look at you staying at a place for more than a year, right? Jesus.
I know. I really do that like to stay places.
That wasn't pizza, you know?
I know.
All right. So, you know, the Loring thing seems pretty good. Why do you leave?
Well, Nick and I had started to talk about opening a restaurant together. You know, it's been a conversation for a long time.
Ongoing,
yeah. You know, just
right.
more casual.
It didn't happen.
Yeah.
It's been something you've both dreamed about
yeah.
with each other?
Well.
Or you, him, and maybe.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and then it kind of came together and. And so, yeah, left ultimately to open this restaurant, Anton's.
Was that shock or a difficult thing at Loring to walk in and say,
yes,
I'm out of here?
Yeah, it was, Loring meant so much to me. I used to get so emotional at, you know, during big moments. It really, because of, you know, what it meant for my life and the way in which I went after the job, and you know, it really, that restaurant meant a lot to me, still does. And
right.
So yes, telling sitting,
I mean, you left for all
down.
The right reasons.
Yeah.
Not because the owner was an asshole or
no.
the environment sucked or it wasn't a successful place. It was all quite the opposite. Unlike some of the people you worked with very early on, if you know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so. You talk about, you know, a relationship with Nick. You're at Loring Place, you know, over a couple of years. You're working with a great guy. How does everything come together? Like, when does discussion become, you know, reality? When do you meet to look at spaces or talk to investors or whatever you do?
Yeah. Well, actually, Nick and I are partners in life and business. So
it's, oh, I didn't know
so,
that.
Yeah. So, I mean,
how long?
A couple of years.
God damn it. How come I didn't pick up on that? It's only a couple of years?
Yeah.
Pretty so, good how the press doesn't. Have you read where it alludes to that anywhere?
No, it doesn't.
I haven't either. You know, I'm a pretty good researcher.
Yeah.
I don't care.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it now, and it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
So it's like you guys want your own place.
Yeah, and I mean, we want our own. We really just wanted to work together because we respect each other as professionals, and I think our relationship, you know, secondarily makes it a strong place, or we you know, because we just truly live and breathe it.
Right.
And
you do it together.
Yeah. And we know each other. We know what the other wants, what the other's expectations are. And so.
So answer my question.
Yeah.
You threw me a curveball.
Sorry.
Which is a great curveball. But where's that moment where, you know, the two of you are like, you're holding hands, walking through the door going, you know, this is it. How does that come about? Who sets that up? You know, what?
Well, Nick had, you know, so he left Union Square Hospitality Group last March. And
he's another story. He's a very busy guy and all that.
Well, at that time, he started talking to a bunch of chefs and restaurateurs, you know, independent restaurateurs whom he respects and admires. And, you know, just saying, hey, this is a pivot moment for me. You know, this is what I'm thinking about doing. Do you have advice? I'd love to hear about your experience, whatever it may be. And so in that series of conversations, he ended up meeting with the Franks, and that's when
Frank Fasanelli and Frank Castronovo from Frankie's in Brooklyn, F&F Pizza.
Yeah. And
did he know them before?
Yeah.
Through the year?
Yeah, through the industry.
So he meets with the idea of maybe keying in with these guys about...
No, just like wanting, again, their advice.
Okay.
Because they've kind of, you know, they were classically trained, but they went out on their own so successfully. You know, they're just like these beloved New York restaurateurs. So he wanted to say, you know, hey, how's it going? How'd you do it? What do you know? What have you learned? And they were intrigued by him, and they said, you know, we have our space in the West Village that we're maybe wanting to move away from, and so let's have that conversation. So Nick was really...
They were willing to have that conversation with Nick in mind.
Yeah, yeah.
Nick went in not knowing that, but certainly when that was thrown on the table, eyes opened wide.
Yeah, he was like, I mean, didn't think that we'd be situating ourselves in, you know, a landmarked corner in the West Village. It's just...
It's like ideal.
It's becoming impossible.
When was that? When was that meeting with... How long?
I would say that was probably late last spring.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're talking a little less than a year ago.
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
Quick.
And then, I mean, we didn't get access to the space until September 30th of...
This past year.
And then...
Just for the record, when did you open?
November 11th.
Okay.
So.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Wait. So I'm jumping ahead, but from September to November, you redo the whole place for opening and all that?
Yeah.
I mean, that's about as nutty and frenetic as it can get, right?
It was wild. It was truly.
So go back. So the Franks and Nick decide this could work, and those guys say the space is yours.
I mean, yeah, there was much negotiation that went on there, but...
Simplistic.
Yeah, but...
They involved, the Franks?
Yes, they remain silent business partners.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did they have their hand in concept or anything, or everything went to you guys?
Yeah,
okay.
not involved in the concept at all.
Okay.
I think they were really excited...
About where you wanted to go.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound dissimilar to the Franks that closed for the wine bar.
Yeah.
You know, kind of a throwback, and we'll talk about that in the middle. All right, so less than a year ago, the project kind of hits the wall. You have a few months to open it up. We'll talk about the restaurant and the wine program in a minute. I just want to talk to you a little about, you know, New York restaurants, the market, before we, like I said, key in on that.
Yeah.
So this kind of marks a decade that you've been in the market. You know, you left for Boulder and all that.
Yeah.
Do you see any major changes in the market? I mean, do you look back and go, holy crap? Or is it the same?
I mean, I think restaurants have changed a lot.
How?
I think that, I don't know, there's a shift. There's a shift to the smaller, there was a momentary shift to smaller restaurants, right? Like with what I mentioned before, Contra, and while there's some like really cool little.
Even like a Frenchette's not that big.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Casual?
Casual. But in the last couple of years, of course, we've seen the, you know, the big restaurateur names, you know, restaurants in hotels, restaurants in shopping malls. So I think that shift is definitely new and wild for New York. Just see, you know, diners going to dinner at a shopping mall. I mean, that reminds me of some of the restaurants that I went to as a kid in Denver. Right. You know, the fancy restaurants that were on the corner edges of, you know, Cherry Creek Mall.
I think the good news is that a lot of hotels and malls and all of that just either brought chains or crap people in. You know, now they realize to partner up with an established chef or a guy with a good concept makes it a better place.
Yeah.
So we definitely think things have gone casual, but they're still small and big. Do you think the audience has changed? Are millennials driving the market? Or?
Yeah.
I mean, when you guys open a restaurant, who did you think the core clientele would be?
Well, we wanted to open a restaurant that for the neighborhood. So we both love New York. I've told you a bit about how I love it. Nick grew up here. He loves it. And we want neighborhoods, little neighborhoods to survive, and little neighborhood shops, restaurants, you know, retail, you know, the landscape of a corner of a stretch of a street. We want those.
That's the really, demo runs the gamut in a neighborhood like that.
Yeah.
Young hipsters, old people that have been there, you know, longer.
Yeah.
So you sort of have to service everybody. You know, we were talking about this off air. There's not a lot of ton of women that are running restaurants, certainly not opening them and running them. And even in wine service, although New York's done a better job than some other markets, it's sort of disproportionate. Do you think this still takes place in New York when you look around, or are you too distracted to realize?
I mean, we have some strong female restaurateur neighbors. You know, we have Rita and Jody around the corner from us who are absolutely killing
it. They're the best.
It's incredible what they do. We just walk by their restaurant sometimes just to see, like, the mob scene. And we enjoy their restaurants.
Well, it's not like you're empty.
No, not at all.
At all, yeah.
No, but they're,
they've been,
you know,
doing it
something
for a while.
To study there, you know, to see what their formula is. Yeah, they're super impressive. So I think there are some great examples, you know, Missy Robbins, of course.
So things are changing for the better. I think New York, like I said, is a good representation of that, because you just named top of the game.
Yeah.
I mean, Missy Robbins, Rita and Jody are, you know, as good as it can get.
Yeah, and outside of restaurants, you know, bars as well. You have Ivy Mix, and you have the head bartender right now at Death & Co. is
that's
a woman.
That's not an issue.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's an issue, but...
Right. What about being a woman, opening a restaurant, any issues with that? I mean, for all the discussions there are about the industry and women, do you ever feel that as, you know, being the lead person?
I mean, I think I have to say yes to that. You know, I think it's there, but I try not to focus on it. It's just if someone's not going to, if some, I take control of it. If someone's not willing to engage or not willing to listen because I'm a woman, then I'm going to have to sidestep around that person and find a way. It's just, right. It's unacceptable. And it's, and I don't want that conversation. I know it's important. We have to talk about it, but I think we can exhaust it as well. And, you know, let's just commit to.
I mean, I had a discussion with my last guest. We were talking about diversity and he yelled at me because he said, all we're doing is talking about it. And I'm like, all right, you know, so, you know, what are things that we could do and all of that? You know, my job is just to somewhat, you know, point it out or talk to people about experience and, you know, their take on it and all of that. Because you're sort of in the thick of it.
Yeah.
You know, you came through New York as a woman wine person and now you're running a place. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about, you know, how the whole Anton's thing came together, you know, next level. We talked about it a little, but you had a major hand in putting it together. And then all the elements of what makes, you know, a buzzy restaurant, you know, buzzy and all that. So we're talking to Natalie Johnson. Natalie is the general manager and beverage director at Anton's. Anton's is a new restaurant in New York City that sort of exemplifies what New York can do. Great wine people, great chef, great vibe, all of that. So when we come back, we'll talk more about the restaurant. We'll talk more about the wine program and a few other things. You're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
This episode is presented by Henry's Wine and Spirit, a go-to shop for anyone interested in natural wines and boutique spirits. There's a large selection of everything from orange wines, pet nats, and reds from around the world. Whether visiting the shop in person or online, looking for a gift for a loved one, or that everyday dependable bottle, you're sure to find lots of interesting wines at Henry's. There's free shipping on orders over $300 on the website henrys.nyc, and case discounts when you visit the store located in Bushwick. Cheers.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Natalie Johnson, GM and Bev Director of Anton's in New York City. All right, Natalie, let's get into the restaurant and the wine program a little. You had your hand in all aspects of opening the restaurant. Things are a little more clear to me now, understanding what's going on with Nick and how everything's set up and all of that. And I realized you had a very short period to open the restaurant. So the cool question is, you never really, at Loring Place you had a little hand in it.
Yeah.
But you never really opened a restaurant in your career to the extent that you did here.
Yeah.
The obvious thing seems to me that the time thing was crazy. You had no time. So just don't spend a ton of time, but what are all the elements? It's literally ordering glasses and food and tell me what that's like.
It's everything. Let me make sense of it. It was such a whirlwind. We obviously were working on the concept, you know, just on paper and sculpting the idea and the feel of Anton's far before we actually got access to the space.
All right, so let's key in on that a little.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the concept.
Yeah.
Because you walk in there, you look at the menu, you look at the place, there's a vibe there.
Yeah.
What is the concept?
We have called it a nostalgic New York cafe and wine bar, and it's very much inspired by late 1800s, kind of turn of that century.
1800 New York restaurants or dining or both?
Dining, yeah. Okay. There was kind of this dining revolution that was happening in New York from what we, you know, can see and understand, where, you know, before that time, New York was really just all these neighborhoods, little pockets of neighborhoods, you know, where you would go if you weren't cooking at home. You'd go to a neighborhood tavern or bar and have, you know, one of a few dishes maybe that were being served that day. But kind of mid to late 1800s, there was a real dining revolution in New York that was happening when a lot of Europeans were bringing the more now modern concept of dining.
Were you looking at menus from that era?
Yeah, yeah. There's an amazing archive online on the New York Public Library, this old archive of menus going back to, I think you can find stuff back to the 1700s.
You guys pored over it for suggestions and dishes?
Yeah, it's just so fun. They're so visually beautiful, too. It's scanned copies of, like, these beautifully ornate menus that have all these, you know, just now exotic-sounding things. We also have the Epicurean, which is the Charles Ranhofer, was one of the famous chefs of Delmonico's. And so we've, you know, pored over the pages of that book.
So what do you decide? It's going to be a large menu, a curated menu? You know, there's so many dishes and you're looking at such a era.
Yeah, we wanted it. We knew that we wanted it to evoke an old world feel. You know, it definitely has this old world feel. There's some distinct European influence
in the
food.
Let's tick off some dishes across the board, like appetizers and main dishes that are good examples of executing that vision.
Well, the first section on the menu is called Bar Bites and Relishes. Relishes, you know, we love the language of these old menus as well. Relishes was a section we saw on a lot of these menus that was little, like, snacky bites, little kind of savory things to, you know, activate your palate. So we have Hudson Rarebit, we call it Hudson Rarebit because of our location.
But cheese and cheesy bread
toast.
Yeah,
it's a classic.
It's not
English,
rabbit.
English pub snack, no
right,
rabbit
right.
There
that's old school.
And some of these menus would have entire rarebit sections, you know, rarebits with
different stuff,
ham,
in it. Yeah,
anchovies,
yeah.
So that's definitely something not to miss.
What about main dishes?
Main dishes are straightforward, really kind of comfort foods that are, you know.
Is comfort food synonymous with that era or not necessarily? Well, there were things like lobster Newburgh in those days.
Yeah, exactly.
Fancy schmancy stuff.
I think what makes Nick's food so great is just how honest it is. It's just, you know, he has, his palate's incredible, but his food is just honest. He wants it to be hot on the plate. You know, there's an immediacy
hot temperature
to it. Yeah, I mean, there's an immediacy to it. It's not over plated or, you know, over analyzed.
Isn't this somewhat of a departure from what he was doing every day for years?
Not really. I mean, if you think about what he was doing, he was cooking Roman food, which is a really kind of, it is a
within
humble,
that category, he stayed true to that.
Yeah.
So you came with the wine background. Nick has the back room, but he has an eye for the front of the room. You're doing the front, GM and beverage. Did you sit down with Nick, obviously, and say, okay, this is our menu?
We talked a lot about the menu together. Yeah.
Where does the wine list go? Let's talk about the wine list now.
The wine list is, you know, represents classic European regions. So there's definitely a focus on Italy, France, Germany, Austria, Spain, and then American wine as well.
Where is the bulk or the strength?
A lot of Italian.
A lot of Italian, which represents your background and love and all that.
Yeah, I just love Italian wine. There's a, you know, there's a friendliness to Italian wine that just comforts me and excites
a diversity.
Me. An incredible diversity. Right. It's just, it's really an enticing.
Let's talk about the list. How big is it? And was it difficult to curate a list? How big is it?
It's about, well, in-house we have about 600 selections. On the list right now, I'd say probably 500.
Okay.
Bottle, unique selections. And we had a unique opportunity because we So the Frankie's last service was September 29th as Frankie's 570. We got in there the morning of September 30th.
Wow.
And basically, you know, walked into a restaurant. So we cleaned it out, but we had a lot to work with, right? So we had a lot of, you know, the china, glass, and silver we're still working with, the chairs and a lot of the tables.
And, fit the vision.
Yeah, and...
it wasn't dissimilar to what you wanted to do.
No, it was kind of perfect. But so I did acquire some of John Patterson's wine inventory as well. So that was nice. I mean, opening a restaurant, starting a business.
Wait, so when you took it over, they had their wine list... You sat with John and said, we'll keep this, we'll keep that, or what he was willing to give you?
I didn't know we didn't have that sit down. That would have been nice. I would have
should have called me.
No, but there, you know, there was some wine that we were walking into. We were walking into an existing cellar, so
right.
A lot of Italian wine there. But outside of that, you know, there's a lot that we've brought in.
So you brought in everything we discussed. Anything sort of interesting or different? You know, is there something, if you look on the list, maybe a trademark of yours or something? I mean, anything cool?
Yeah, I mean, I love wines from Sicily, Corsica, these kind of funky regions that have great history and tradition, but where you can find really incredible value.
So while we're on that, I always like to drop some knowledge on our listeners. So let's not spend too much time on it. But Sicily, let's talk about some varietals, some regions, and some specific makers.
Okay.
You know, and I think you talked about, you know, value and all that, which I think the area kind of, you know, is known for.
Yeah.
Give me a couple of good Sicilian wines.
Well, I mean, you have Marsala on, you know, the western coast.
Marsala wine?
Marsala wine.
Like chicken Marsala wine?
Well, that's the thing.
Drink it straight up?
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite producers, Marco De Bartoli, makes some really beautiful, incredible Marsala.
Is it a sweet wine or a dry wine or somewhere in between?
Sweet.
Okay.
He makes dry wine. He makes dry still whites. He makes sparklings in the champagne method, but he also makes, you know, sweet fortified Marsalas.
You answered the question perfectly because I asked for something interesting. And Marsala is certainly... What about more traditional? The volcanic wines of Sicily?
Yeah.
What grape? Etna.
What we're drinking right now. I love this wine.
Which we'll talk about.
Yeah.
But the grape is Nero...
Nerello Mascalese.
Right. Give me a good maker or two.
Benanti...
Great guys.
Ayunta.
Okay.
Paso Pisciaro.
Good ones. You mentioned Corsica, which everyone thinks is Italian, but it's French. But tell me something besides Abitucci that's good there.
Abitucci. Maestracci. Sebastian Poli at Stilucionu. Use Stilucionu.
What? I asked people to spell it, but that may be too hard. Spell it.
S-T-I-L. I always get lost. I'll look it up every time.
I post, you know, our wine list and what we're drinking and any good recos. What grape or grapes are prominent in Corsica?
Sciaccarello.
Right.
Yeah, that's what the Stilucionu that I love is their entry level, the Antica Sciaccarello.
Right.
Which is just like really kind of has this core of red fruit and it's crunchy. And, you know, you find a lot of volcanic soil around Corsica as well.
Yeah. Those are wines people should be trying and tasting. Yeah. And they're not inaccessible or expensive.
No.
So I will post all of that. You have a decent size by the glass program. Why is that? Something you've always done, something you wanted to do?
Yeah.
I know why a buy the glass program is a great thing as a wine consumer. Tell me why you wanted to do that with over like 20 selections or something.
Yeah. Well, it's your access point to the wine program. It's the way that I think you can send the message most clearly that, you know, everyone is welcome to drink wine here. You know, you have to have an enticing buy the glass program because... Not everyone wants to open a bottle. Not everyone can afford a bottle. Maybe tonight, you know, you just want a half glass of wine. We have that for you. We want everyone to feel comfortable and welcomed into the wine program, and the by the glass list is the best way to do that.
Does that give you a chance to commit to wines that you don't have to buy cases of, or you know, you could bring in some funky wines, or you can move stuff in and out to see how people are reacting? I mean,
yeah,
the internal science of it all, besides giving, you know, everyone, is that why a buy the glass program's fun for you?
Yeah, I mean, your buy the glass program also needs to make you money. It allows you the ability to do other interesting things with your list, create pockets of value elsewhere. So you do need it to work for you, but you can find...
Is that a profitable part of the list? Buy the glass?
Yeah.
That's a good spot and all that?
Yeah, but you should still be offering, which is why I think a lot of, you know, restaurants don't have great buy the glass programs, because they're just trying to buy the cheapest wines.
Well, that's what people perceive.
Yeah.
The glass, the BTG is the crap stuff.
Yeah.
You know, if you go into a good place with a good wine person, you know they're bringing in some cool stuff.
Yeah.
And you have access to stuff, you know, that most people don't have. How important is... Well, before I ask that question, you also have a passion for mixed drinks and beer and all of that, and there's a good representation of it. I read something... I don't even know what the hell this is. What's a cold batched martini?
Oh, yeah, our icebox martini.
What are we talking here?
So it's a... We pre-stir the martini, our house martini, which is a Beefeater gin martini, which is how I like to drink it.
Traditional, fits the theme and all that.
So we pre-stir it with...
Wait, what's a tradition? So Beefeater, a little vermouth?
Yep, a little Dolan dry vermouth, and just a touch of water.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because if you can imagine, you know, stirring a proper martini, you're getting just a little bit of dilution from the ice.
And then dealer's choice, if the guy wants an olive or a lemon rind, or is there a way you serve it?
There's a way that I like to drink it, which is with a twist and an olive.
Okay.
Yeah.
Going crazy on me here. All right. So there's a mixed spirits program there. There's some interesting stuff thematic to the whole place.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the type of boozes and drinks and throwback stuff.
Yeah. It's based on classic cocktails. You know, we're not trying to do which is very different from what I was doing at Loring Place.
Right. Same thing, you looked at some old cocktail menus and stuff?
For Loring Place?
No, for here.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, to see what was the thing then and all that.
Yeah.
Very cool. What about the beers?
Beers are, again, I think, you know, fit what we're trying to do really well, kind of classic styles, nothing too crazy. We're not, like, featuring five IPAs.
What's, like, a core foundation beer there?
Guinness.
No, really?
Everyone needs to start coming in. Okay,
listen, you're talking to a Guinness guy.
Yeah.
I love Guinness. So stuff like that.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you how important the wine and drinks program to a restaurant like that is.
I mean, it's...
Two ways.
Yeah.
As far as reflecting what you want to do and the bottom line for business.
Yeah, beverage is important for this business, restaurants, you know. It's how we make money, but we have a responsibility to, you know, mark things up appropriately and not take people for their money. And we're always wanting to do that. So we want a beverage program that is healthy for the business, but one that, like I said, allows people to have bottles of wine, glasses of wine. We want wine on every table.
But one of the nice things is there's... you specialize in, you know, value pricing.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the bottles, 50, 70, 100.
We have good levels of or access at every level. So I want people to be able to drink Burgundy, you know, a great Bourgogne Rouge.
You curate all that stuff.
For under, you know, $90, under $80.
Cool. All right. That's Anton's. I suggest that you get over there, get on the website, look at the menu and all that. I can't let you leave without doing our wine list. Five questions. We ask everybody the same thing. Don't dwell on these. We don't have a ton of time. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? Not this second, but what's in the fridge? switching seasons? What's interesting you?
I love drinking Italian white wines.
Okay, give me regions or wines.
Ligurian Vermentino.
Okay, just I love that.
It. Go back to it.
Give
all
me
the
a
time.
Maker or two.
Bison.
B-I-S-O-N?
B-I-S-S-O-N.
Okay, yeah. Give me one more.
Oh gosh, why can't I?
That's all right. Anything? Yeah. That's all right. What else? Give me one other thing you're drinking now.
Champagne.
All right. Do
I
you
crave it?
Do you focus on any producer because they're reasonable, or I mean, we all love Solas or whatever.
Yeah.
But what are you drinking?
Marc Ebrard, I always love from
right.
Valle de la Marne.
H-E-B-R-A-R-T?
Yes, Ebrard? H-E-B-R-A-R-T.
All right. Good on that. Do you have a favorite wine and food pairing? Not something you eat every night, or but when you do it, or like if Nick makes something, you go, you know, it's perfect with this. Chicken,
well, we
peanut.
Are always like, ooh, try this with that, try this with that. It's
what's
fun.
Making sense lately?
There's a Szechuan restaurant on 3rd Avenue and 25th that has the most delicious dry hot pepper chicken.
Mm.
You know, just covered in chilies, Szechuan peppercorns, which is obviously a really difficult thing to pair with. And
so what
I've
goes with
that?
I've
had this dish many times. I have found that like a very juicy Beaujolais goes very well with that.
Give me a juicy Beaujolais you like. Is it a Morgon?
I do love the wines of Morgon. Yeah, La Pierre. Bottle of La Pierre Morgon. Yeah.
A La Pierre Morgon would go well with that dish.
It would.
So spicy Szechuan with peppers all over the place and a juicy Beaujolais.
Yeah.
I'm liking that.
Okay.
Do you have, I know you've been crazy for a while, and you may not even get out, but if you do, or favorite wine restaurant or bar, who's doing it well? Who's doing what you're doing? Great vibe, great list, curated, good knowledge. Where else can you walk into and feel that?
I do enjoy Four Horsemen whenever I get to...
In Brooklyn.
...get out to Brooklyn. I like to visit my buddy Brandon at Charlie Bird.
Uh-huh.
He runs
Charlie
the program
Bird's
at Charlie
a show
Bird
favorite. Give me one more.
I like to go uptown to Nice Matin.
What's his name?
Aviram.
Yeah, he just got married.
I like to eat French fries and drink white burgundy there.
Or champagne or Chablis or whatever.
Yeah.
All right.
It's a great, great list.
The question is favorite all-time wine. It's morphed into what's a wine that is important to you or is a favorite?
We've talked a lot about Italian wines. It, like I said, it's my love. I love the wines of Piedmont. I think they are...
Are we talking Barolo or
Barolo
beyond?
Barolo Barbaresco.
Okay.
Yeah.
Lange and stuff like that?
Yeah, I just think Nebbiolo is the most exotic, enticing
varietal.
So
it's easy to talk about all the famous big guys, you know, Mascarello. What's a good accessible Barolo? Not too expensive. You could find it in a better store.
I think the wines from Brezza are really great.
Oh, B-R-E-Z-Z-A?
B-R-E-Z-Z-A, yeah.
Okay. That's a region or one of the sections.
That's a producer.
Brezza is the producer.
Brezza is the producer, yeah.
And he's good value producer.
Yeah.
Okay. Give me one more. Can you think of one more?
Yeah. Serafina Rivella from Barbaresco.
Okay.
Really, really elegant wine.
That's the maker, Serafina.
Rivella.
Rivella.
Yeah.
Never heard of it. I'm going to post all that, like I said. Last question. Best wine around $15, 15 to 20. Give me a red and a white. My kids can't afford to look like idiots and bring $9, $10 crappy bottles, and they don't have the money for 40. So how do you impress 15, 20, 22, 23? What do you can give me a category like white Muscadet. You can give me makers.
Yeah. I think Canary Islands is a great place to look right now for both white and red. It's really exciting.
And wine. They're in that $20 range and all of that?
They are, really.
Give me
valuable.
A producer. I mean, does Envenate make wines in that range?
Yeah.
Or the, who?
I think those wines tend to be just
a little
bit over.
So who are you thinking?
Los Bermejos. Makes white, rosé, and red. Fronton de Oro is another producer.
Spell that for me.
Fronton Day, D-E, Oro.
Okay.
Oro.
I'll figure it all out. Yeah. Those are good ones.
Canary Islands.
All right, so good job. Quick, concise, interesting. Kudos to you on that. All right, Natalie, we got to wrap up the show, but before we wrap up the show, it's always fun to ask my guests to raid the cellar with something that's accessible, reasonable, and good and cool. So you brought in a 2017 Sicilian wine.
Yep.
Quickly tell me what it is.
Etna Rosso. I can't get away from Italy, from Sicily. So this is mostly Nerello Mascalese with a little Nerello Cappuccio from a newer producer, Ayunta. Oh, sorry. That's I need to right. pour you more bad Psalm.
That's right. I'm off mic because I'm drinking. wait. So what was the second grape?
Nerello Cappuccio.
Cappuccio.
Yeah.
All right. And the producer is?
Ayunta. Yeah.
A-Y-U-N-T-A.
Yeah.
Never heard of them.
Young gentleman. His family was based in southern Sicily. And then they kind of got out of the wine business, and then he wanted to get back into it. He actually worked as a somm, I think. I don't know where. And decided he wanted to start, the family tradition again. So he bought some old vines on Etna.
Is he making limited production?
Yeah, it's pretty small production. He makes a couple whites, a couple reds, and I think the
what
wines
are his
very vivid.
Vineyard and cellar practices? Is he pretty sustainable?
Yeah, he says it's all about the wine. A little bit of aged just adds a little bit of sulfites.
Okay. Well, a little sulfur.
A little sulfur, yeah.
We're not zero sulfur all the time. All right, let's do a quick evaluation. Color, is that typical for this wine, or is it a little lighter?
I would say this is pretty typical, yeah. These wines have really beautiful kind of brightness and clarity, and just that really beautiful
the clarity
sort
is,
of ruby
you know, it is
fruit.
A yeah. Let's do nose now. Give me your nose descriptors. Let's get that schnoz in there.
So aromatically lifted, like just kind of bursting from the glass, really lovely red fruits, like juicy kind of almost candied red fruit, mm-hmm. but like a little floral as well.
A little floral.
Red rosy.
What about the mouthfeel? Let's throw it over the tongue and talk about mouthfeel and the palate. Like a medium?
Medium body. This is why I love these wines. There's just this incredible, refreshing acidity, but Nerello Mascalese has tannin. There's structure, there's body, there's ripeness, but also just lovely freshness. So these wines can really, be applied to so many dining moments.
Good food wine.
Good
wine.
Good food wine.
I should get it in my mouth next
time.
All right. Palate. Does the palate reflect a bunch of the nose descriptors, or are we picking other stuff up on it?
Yeah, it's fruit and it's mineral, yeah. The minerality on Etna comes through.
Yeah,
you
because it's volcanic soil.
And you have soil that's kind of changing all the time because of the active nature of Etna. A lot of just really beautiful kind of soft tannin mineral texture. I know that's a tricky word to use, but
What do we pair this with? We talked about the tannins and all. It's a good food wine. What are the classic pairs?
Pizza, tomato,
red sauce type stuff and all that.
Yeah.
So this is a good pizza wine.
I think.
What do you think the retail on this bottle is? Ballpark.
Probably right around 30 retail.
Okay. Yeah. So that's the 2017 Ayunta. What does it say under Ayunta?
Navigabile.
Navigabile. I will post all of that. Thank you for bringing in the cool wine.
Yeah,
I mean, I've had a bunch of Sicilian wines, but this is great. Natalie, I'm sad to say we have to wrap up and I have to let you go. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation, on Instagram at SBenRuby, on Twitter at BenRuby. I know, confusing. But you can always use the hashtag The Grape Nation on both. As I mentioned, we'll post Natalie's wine list answers. I'll spell everything out. I'll clarify everything. Probably have to call you a couple times. And I will post our weekly wine sip, which is a delicious, fun wine that's worth seeking out. Is this, can you find this out there? Not easy?
I've been so at the restaurant. I don't know if this is popped up in shops. It is newer to...
I'll establish whether it's approachable or
but
not.
But you can find it at Anton's, so...
Right. That's the other thing. Yeah. All right. Natalie, if we want to follow you and Anton's on social media, where do we go?
Anton's is at Anton's NYC.
See?
And I am Fat Nat.
I couldn't find you.
Drinks wine underscore eats pizza.
All right. So from here on in, it's... Wait. Give that to me again.
Fat Nat.
Underscore?
No. Fat Nat drinks wine underscore eats pizza.
Jesus Christ.
Find me
should
there.
Throw you out of here right now with that. So. It's a good thing your email isn't like that. I'd email you once and tell you goodbye, you know? All right. Thank you to our guest, Natalie Johnson. Natalie is overseeing... a very hot new restaurant that's been reviewed this week by the New York Times and generally gave it a pretty good review. How do we feel about it?
We are mildly disappointed by the review, but, ready to move forward and take what it said and be better every day.
I think it's better than what the Times said.
Yeah.
Listen, you got... one more star than Peter Luger. Okay. So, all right, Natalie, thanks for coming in, especially in the midst of everything that's going on. I was waiting for a text or a phone call that's like, I can't.
No,
you know, so I love you for coming in and thank you for that. Thank you to our engineer, Amanda, and everyone at The Grape Nation. I'm Sam Ben Rubin. You've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.